This is Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam. Imagine there's a point system for your life, a tally of every action you've ever taken and how that action affected the world for good or ill. How do you think you'd fare?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to your first day in the afterlife.
People have asked variations of this question for centuries. In the TV show, The Good Place, a system that tallies the good and bad things you've done determines whether you end up somewhere pretty great or, well, the other place.
Every one of your actions had a positive or a negative value, depending on how much good or bad that action put into the universe.
As with the TV show, philosophers have found that being a good person can be complicated.
Eleanor farted and then she blamed it on her chair. That's going to cost her at least a few points.
Today, we're going to explore two stories about people doing their best to do good in the world and how their actions affected others around them. We begin with the tale of Kelly Gillespie. She was living in London a couple of years ago when she decided to take a psychology class. The class was online, hosted by the education platform Coursera. It was taught by Scott Plouse. He's a psychologist at Wesleyan University.
And then my life changed after doing Professor Plouse's course. And now I'm studying to be a psychotherapist and counselor.
Kelly's class with Scott taught her several new psychological concepts. One is called the norm of reciprocity. If you're nice to someone or you open up to them, they're likely to do the same with you. She also learned about the power of empathy. When you put yourself in someone else's shoes, it profoundly changes the relationship that you have with them. Now, lots of people learn about ideas in psychology class, but Kelly did something unusual. She took what she had learned in the class and she applied it in her own life.
As well, I also like books and novels, so I spend a lot of time at the British Library at King's Cross. And my husband works just around the corner from there, so every Friday afternoon I would meet him out of work after I'd been at the British Library researching. And I would finish about 4 o'clock, he would finish about 6 o'clock, so I had a couple of hours to spend. Sometimes I'd go to the welcome, sometimes I'd just sit and have a coffee and watch people walking by. And always the same young guy. And always smiling, despite not having anywhere to live or not having a job or any money. But he was always so pleasant. And it started off simply me giving him what spare change I had. But it went on for a couple of months. And I got to know him a little bit and know what had happened to make him leave home and come to London.
Kelly learned his name was Simon. She asked him if he would sit down with her for a cup of coffee.
He was just walking past on the other side of the road. I think he walked up and down Tottenham Court Road all day. And on a night, he would get onto the night buses because he had nowhere to sleep. He would just get on the night bus and travel round and round and round until 6 o'clock in the morning, hoping to sleep, hoping to not get attacked by the junks and the people that use the night buses in London. To make him feel comfortable, I told him a little bit about my life. I told him I was waiting for my husband. I told him how long we'd been together, things like that. And I think by sharing a little bit of my life made him more confident to talk about his life. And I found out, I mean, he wasn't from far away from London, just in Kent on the southeast coast.
And what's going through your head about what you can say or do that would be helpful?
He kept mentioning how much he missed his mum, how much he was so close to his mum. And that's a relationship that should never be damaged. So I think that led to me asking him, would he like to speak to his mum? And he said, yeah, he never had a problem with his mum. It was because of his father that he left home. And he loved his mum very much. And I just thought, if you love someone so much, you shouldn't be so distant from them.
Kelly eventually found Simon's mom. She gave her a call.
And I said, I'm a friend of Simon's. She started crying immediately because she hadn't heard from him in 3 years. She didn't know whether he was alive or dead. And at that moment, I thought, okay, I'm just going to pass the phone over and let them talk. They talked for about 10 minutes, 15 minutes. It was quite beautiful to watch because he started off not knowing what to say and being very guarded and defensive. That all broke down within 5 minutes. And he didn't tell them that he was homeless. He didn't mention that at all. He just said, I've been living in London. Everything's okay. I'm still alive. He never mentioned his situation at all, though.
And once the conversation was over, what did you say to him and how did things go from there?
I got a little bit bossy, actually. And I said, okay, this isn't going to solve itself. So we went to Victoria coach station and bought him a ticket on the next bus to go back to Southend. And that's the last I saw of him. He got on the bus and away he went.
In terms of what you've done with since Simon, has it changed your behavior? Have you always been somebody who goes up to homeless people and helps them? Or have you actually become more proactive because you sort of say, I realize that I actually can make a difference. And maybe I can't make a difference on a mass scale, but I certainly made a difference in one person's life. And that teaches me that I could make a difference in other people's lives too.
I think that doing the course with Professor Plouffe most definitely opened my eyes to the reasons why people don't do something to help. And I can remember he told us this wonderful story as part of the course, which was told originally, I think, by a Kenyan environmental activist called Wangari Mutamatai. And it's a story of a hummingbird in a forest that's being consumed by a wildfire, and all the animals in the forest come out and they're transfixed as they watch the forest burning, and they feel very overwhelmed and very powerless, except this one little hummingbird that says, I'm going to do something about this fire. And Professor Plouffe told us this story about all the animals laughing at this little hummingbird as it flew backwards and forwards from the nearest stream with one drop of water at a time to put out the fire. But at least it was doing something, and it was doing the best it can. And I think that's something that really, really hit a true note with me, that it's easy to say I can't make a difference, but everyone can make a difference.
I first met Scott many years ago. He's a very smart guy. But the thing that leaps out when you meet him is that he's a really nice guy. Scott radiates kindness. The class where Scott connected with Kelly was an online class. Believe it or not, more than 250,000 students from around the world signed up for the class. And at the end of it, Scott gave Kelly and his other students an assignment. It was called the Day of Compassion. Students had to spend one day being deliberately kind and generous toward others. Scott asked them to notice how these actions changed the way they felt about themselves. I asked Scott to tell me what students find when they do this.
Students often report that it's transformative, that they're really surprised at the reaction, that people are so overwhelmingly positive that it starts to feed on itself. We talk about paying it forward, the idea that if you do something good for another person, that that gives the other person a kind of lift, and then that person in turn will do something for somebody else, and it sets off a kind of chain reaction.
So it's not just find the one dramatic thing that you can do in the day that can change the life of someone else. You're actually asking people to change the way they live that day.
That's right. And, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. had a wonderful quote as well about the effect that you have just in eating breakfast, the number of lives that you touch, where the cereal comes from, where the packaging comes from, who brought the cereal to you, where did the milk come from, and so on. And before you know it, you've touched thousands of lives without even realizing it. So the students are asked to look deeply, to think deeply about their life choices, their behaviors, and to think about it specifically in terms of compassion.
So when you're eating your cereal, even if you know that these thousands of people have touched your cereal, how do you act compassionately toward all of them?
Well, in some cases, you might be thinking about people who are working under unfair labor conditions. You might be thinking, if I throw away this food, what else am I throwing away? You might think about when you drive to work, could you be bicycling? Could you be walking? What consequences are there for other people? So there are many, many different connections that we normally don't have time to think about. And in this assignment, I ask students to simply slow down and think about those connections.
You know, it's interesting when we actually start thinking about this in great detail, we often realize then that we're making choices that even though we think of ourselves as being good people, those choices are often unsupportable by the values that we claim to have. You know, in my book, I talk about the idea that, you know, I was discussing the role that childhood vaccines play in saving children's lives in many parts of the world and how, you know, for $200, you could probably save a child's life in a poor country by making sure that she has access to just a suite of childhood vaccines. And when I gave my daughter a birthday party, this was a couple years ago, and the birthday party cost $200 or $250, I had a moment where I stopped and said, I'm spending $250 on my child's birthday party, and the same $250 could save the life of a child halfway around the world. Now, how is it possible that one child's birthday party could be more important than another child's life? And I felt like a terrible human being.
Well, I'm sorry you feel terrible about that, but at least having a level of awareness, I think, can be a positive thing. The Princeton philosopher Peter Singer has a great example of this. He talks about somebody who's walking past some water and sees a child drowning, and this person happens to be in very fancy clothes, let's say an Armani suit or some very expensive shoes. And the question is, if you're the only one there and the only one capable of saving the child and there's no time to spare, should you, in fact, ruin your suit? Should you ruin your shoes and save the life? Let's say that you would lose $200 doing that. And almost everybody would say, of course, the child's life is worth more than the $200. And then Peter Singer turns around and says, well, what if we could demonstrate that there's a child's life halfway around the world and that $200 would be sufficient to save that life? Why aren't you spending the $200?
And of course, the question is, lots of us don't. The child in the pond who's drowning feels visceral to us and feels like our responsibility in ways that the child halfway around the world does not feel like our responsibility.
That's exactly right. There's an immediacy there. There's a vividness and there's different consequences when you see somebody personally in need rather than having somebody be abstract and remote. And people will say to themselves, well, maybe that's true, but there are so many children in need. If I gave each one $200, I would be left in poverty. I can't possibly do that. And this is where psychology comes in. We tell ourselves stories about why it's okay not to help, why it's okay not to help once. And we say, well, because if I then did once, I would have to do 100, and I couldn't possibly do that. But in fact, sometimes you can do one, and one is better than zero.
One is better than zero. That's true much of the time. But there are also moments in life when a situation isn't this black and white. Moments when it's not clear whether we should jump in and help or leave well enough alone. That ambiguity is something that surgeon Don Laub has grappled with for years. His story and the case that has haunted him for decades, when we come back. I'm Shankar Vedantam, and you're listening to Hidden Brain. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from C3. C3's AI software suite enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale to solve previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at c3.ai. And from CBS All Access, with the new season of its original series, The Good Fight, Christine Baranski returns to lead the fight. Now streaming on CBS All Access. More at cbs.com/thegoodfight.
This is Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam. We like stories about leaders who have big ideas, who defy the odds and pursue their goals with messianic purpose. But what happens when a leader's vision is the wrong one? How do we think about people who dream big only to invite disaster? At such times, we might prefer a more cautious style, someone who plays the odds. Those leaders might not score historic triumphs, but they rarely cause catastrophes. Thousands of years ago, the Greek poet Archilochus summed up this idea. He said, "The fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one big thing."
That parable has been the subject of much debate over the last 2,500 years, what exactly Archilochus meant.
This is psychologist Phil Tetlock.
Various people have offered various interpretations, some people coming out on the side of the hedgehog, saying the hedgehog will trump the fox, and other people saying, no, it really means the fox is going to do better.
There are different ways to think about the metaphor, but here's how I see it. If a fox wants dinner, it has many options. It can chase down a hedgehog, it can find something else to eat. It can even go without food for a day. But if you're a hedgehog being chased by a fox, you don't have multiple goals. You have one overarching idea. Don't get eaten. Tetlock thinks this metaphor also describes two cognitive styles in people. Foxes have different strategies for different problems. They're comfortable with nuance. They can live with contradictions. Hedgehogs focus on the big picture. They see every problem through the lens of a single organizing principle.
The hedgehogs are more parsimonious, more decisive. In most MBA programs, they'd probably be viewed as better leadership material.
Today on Hidden Brain, we have the story of a hedgehog, a surgeon who changed the world in daring ways. But before we can meet him, we need to introduce you to one of his patients. Sandy Stone was born in 1936 in the midst of the Great Depression. Her parents gave her a Hebrew name.
It was Zelig Ben Natan.
Zelig Ben Natan, a boy's name. That's because her parents thought she was a boy. But from a very early age, she knew she was a girl. This was a long time ago, decades before the modern trans movement. When Sandy was a child, there were no words, no language to describe what she knew about herself.
It was lonely, it was disorienting, it was puzzling, confusing, scary. It was all of those things.
It stayed like that for Sandy all the way into adulthood. She went to school, became a recording engineer, moved to the Bay Area. All the while, everyone thought she was a man. She kept searching for help. In the San Francisco phone book, she found a promising lead. It was a group for gay men. When she called, they asked if she was gay. She said she wasn't. So they sent her away and told her to try another group. The outfit they recommended surprised Sandy. It was the San Francisco Police Department.
It turned out that the police department was running a counseling unit of sorts, which they did for the population of transgender people that lived in the San Francisco Tenderloin, which was sort of the down-and-out Skid Row section of town that tended to collect people who couldn't afford to live anywhere else or who had run out of options.
Trans people who ended up in the Tenderloin were at high risk for drug addiction and prostitution. They were social outcasts. When Sandy got in touch with the police to ask for help, the first thing they did was to dissuade her from acting on her feelings.
And they actually tried to discourage me by taking on a tour that reminded me of Dante being led down into the lower circles of hell. They really showed me the worst of everything and then said, "Are you sure you still want to go ahead with what you're thinking of?" And to be perfectly honest, I was not quite sure what I was thinking of. I was just trying to collect information. And I think it would be safe to say that that's what we were all doing at that time.
Still, the referral to the police turned out to be a stroke of luck. The cops told her that a center at Stanford University had recently started performing what were then called sex change operations.
They didn't refer me to Stanford as much as talk about it, as the great unattainable goal, the great beautiful shining star in the sky.
After years of suffering and loneliness and confusion, the Stanford program felt like a beacon. Sandy felt she might finally have a chance to live a more honest, satisfying life. But first, she had to convince the gatekeeper who stood between her and the person she wanted to become. He ran what was then called the Gender Dysphoria Program at Stanford. His name was Don Lobb. The gatekeeper of Stanford's Gender Dysphoria Program was a hedgehog. From a very early age, he had a big picture idea. He wanted to help people. He wanted to help a lot of people. As a small child, when kids in his school were asked to donate money to a charity, his classmates contributed a dime. Don worked in a vegetable garden an entire summer to raise a whopping $10.
Now, I got a letter, a preserved letter from that my mother wrote to some of her friends saying, "Don, he has done something that nobody has ever done."
Don's father feared his little boy was consumed with being a do-gooder, that he would turn out to be a failure at business. His father was right. Don Lobb became a doctor. When he came to Stanford in the 1960s, he was a young, ambitious plastic surgeon, very much in awe of his prize-winning colleagues.
Coming to Stanford, I was overshadowed by the hugeness of what people were doing, the importance of it. So I knew that I had to do something, like maybe, you know, I got to do this somewhere along the line because everybody else here is doing it.
Don was looking for a place to make his mark. One day, a colleague walked out of an examination room and came up to him.
And said, "Don, I want you to see a patient. It's a good case. You might not like it. It's a sex change."
Remember, this was 1968.
I said, "Dave, send that patient away. I'm a Catholic boy from the Midwest, and I'm at Stanford. We don't do those things."
But Don's colleague insisted he meet the patient. To be clear, this patient was not Sandy Stone.
And he said, "Do me a favor and go in that room." So I went in the room and talked to the patient. And I said, "Now, why do you want the sex change?" She said, "Well, I was born that this is what I should be." I said, "Well, when did you decide that?" She said, "I didn't decide it. This is what I was born with from day one."
This patient was a pioneer. No one on the West Coast had received what's come to be known today as gender reassignment surgery or gender confirmation surgery. In fact, the surgery had been rarely performed across the whole world. Don was an unlikely choice of doctor. He was, by his own account, a prim man from the Midwest. But although Don initially blanched at the idea of gender reassignment surgery, he felt a shiver of excitement. He didn't send the patient away. Instead, he went looking for information. He consulted with psychiatrists and the few surgeons around the world who'd already performed this kind of surgery.
What prompted you, this sort of, Catholic doctor from the Midwest, to basically take this on? It seems like an unlikely fit.
It was a wonderful opportunity to do a big thing and to help a lot of people.
Altruism and ambition were always tightly woven in Don's identity. He wasn't interested in superficial cosmetic work. He wanted to change the world. He decided to take the leap. In November 1968, Don Lobb performed California's first gender reassignment surgery.
Yeah, we were more than prepared for all the things that might happen. And the surgery went fine. It took about 3.5 hours, and we did it with the skin graft method, and no problem.
Don soon became one of the world's leading experts on gender reassignment surgery. He started a program. His reputation grew, a reputation for being a good surgeon and a tough gatekeeper. He turned away many people because he felt they weren't good candidates for surgery. Sandy Stone vividly remembers her first appointment with him in the mid-70s.
I go in and sit down, and Don is behind his desk, and he's wearing his white coat. And he's very distinguished looking and calm and very friendly and open. And he says, "Well, what can I do for you?" And I say the first thing that comes into my head, which is, "I think I'm a woman." Now, the scene we have is Don behind his desk and me. I have a long black beard and wild black hair, I'm wearing a blue shirt, jeans, and engineer's boots. I do not exactly look like I'm thinking of myself as a stereotypical woman. And Don looks at me and says, "Really?" And I say, what should I do? I mean, I'm completely open to anything. I really don't know what I should do, what direction I should move in, what's right, what's wrong. And I'm looking to Donald to tell me. And in my memory of the thing, Donald then says, "Well, the first thing you should do is lose the beard."
That was the beginning of Sandy's long transformative journey. It was a tough journey. Don wanted Sandy to be sure she was making the right decision. So before he would even consider surgery, Sandy says he told her she would have to live openly and fully as a woman for one full year. It was a requirement based on the reality of the time. No one, not Sandy nor Don, knew what might come from these surgeries in the long term. These were early days. It was all a bit of an experiment, a shot in the dark.
It was fraught. It was fraught for everyone. And it was fraught because at that time, it was not clear what would happen later. We didn't have very many examples of transgender people who had had surgery who went on to have fulfilling lives and lived to tell about it, which is to say, came back later and reported back to the program.
They were experimenting on the fringe of what both medicine and society thought was acceptable. Don was taking risks with his professional reputation. Sandy was taking risks with her life. There was one moment, Sandy says, when she and Don clashed. The conflict boiled down to their cognitive styles.
At some point, he asked me if I were 100% committed to wanting surgery. And I said, "No, I'm not. I'm probably 99.9%. I think anyone who's 100% committed to anything is probably crazy. You have to have some reservations in life. You have to have an overview of everything that you're doing and have alternative plans if what you're looking for doesn't work out." And Don said, "Well, in that case, you're not eligible for surgery. You have to be 100% committed."
It took a mediated session with Don's assistant for the two of them to resolve the conflict. But the incident revealed something about the way a hedgehog moves through the world. Hedgehogs are decisive. Don could not understand anything less than 100% commitment, even if the 0.1% of doubt was simply a way to say, "I'm human. How can I be absolutely sure?" Sandy tells another story of a time she came in for an appointment wearing jeans and a t-shirt. Don asked her why she wasn't dressed like a woman. He'd missed the bell-bottom jeans and tie-dye revolution happening right outside his window. It was the kind of thing that could have led to a fight, except for one thing. Sandy understood where Don was coming from. She knew that underneath the tough exterior, he really wanted to help. And not just in a medical sense. More than anything, Don wanted Sandy to live a life where she didn't feel like an outcast.
He wanted his people to be totally unremarkable, to just fit in, to be able to live their lives, to be able to be inconspicuous and just get along. And that's a good thing to want for 99% of your waking day, is just to be able to live your life, to be able to live with other people and not rub people the wrong way.
Sandy Stone successfully underwent surgery in 1977. When I interviewed Sandy, I told her that her story reminded me of another case that Don told me about.
It's interesting because Don first came to my attention because of another case involving cleft lip surgery. And it's so striking that as you're saying this, I'm sort of hearing echoes of that other work as well, this drive that he had to just help people to essentially live what he would think of as being a normal life, a life that they're not ostracized, a life that they're not feeling like they're outcasts, that they're functioning, they can get an education if they're a child, that they can get a job if they're an adult, that they can be happy. And I feel there's something actually very Midwestern about that idea.
That's the word. That word you said is correct. Don wanted people to be happy. Don did it professionally. His job was to help people to be happy. And for that, I owe him a lifetime debt. I would not have done anything, I think, that I did after the 1980s if it weren't for Don Laub, or the 70s, rather, if it weren't for Don Laub.
Sandy went on to become a prominent writer and theorist and eventually helped found the academic discipline of transgender studies. When she considers Don's influence on her life, she homes in on his willingness to pursue a big idea with single-minded purpose.
Do you go for the big one, or do you accept something less? And many of us accept something less because we don't want to take the risk. And then we may go through life, maybe we'll be happy with our measure. Or maybe we'll say, what if I had gone for what I really wanted? What would that have been like? Maybe I would have died. Yeah, maybe I would have. But I didn't. And I went on to be gloriously happy. That's something in life. And Don brought that to many people. I don't see how one could do better than that.
Don's leap into the unknown, his willingness to bet his professional reputation on a big idea, his confidence in his own judgment, it had all paid off. The hedgehog had won. But pursuing a big idea with determination doesn't always pay off. And when a hedgehog fails, the fall can be painful. Don Laub knows about that part of the story, too. Stay with us. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, used by over 3 million businesses for hiring, where employers can post jobs and use screener questions to build their short list of preferred candidates. Learn more at Indeed.com/hire. From Constant Contact, their automation features let customers automatically send welcome and birthday emails, as well as autoresponders when users take an action. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. And from Americans for the Arts.
According to the ancient Greek poet Archilochus, the fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one big thing. Psychologist Phil Tetlock says the metaphor describes two kinds of people. Small picture tacticians are foxes. Big picture strategists are hedgehogs. Before Don Laub became a world-renowned gender reassignment surgeon, he had another big idea. It started this way. One day, a colleague asked him if he could help with the surgery. The patient was a child from Mexico.
This was a 14-year-old boy who had no other deformity than his cleft lip and palate.
But because of it, the boy was shunned. A group of priests had driven him north, all the way to Stanford, to get him help. Don immediately understood that the cleft lip wasn't just a medical problem.
He had not gone to school. He had no educational advancement. He had no friends.
The surgery to repair the cleft lip and palate was simple and quick. It was so easy, and it gave this child a real chance in life. Don says performing the surgery made him feel really good. As someone with deep religious roots and a Catholic education that emphasized helping the poor, Don felt this was the kind of patient he wanted to serve. He turned to the priest who brought the boy from Mexico.
I asked him, are there other patients in Mexico like this? They said, well, the place is full of them. So we bought an airplane ticket and went down to Mexicali and asked for a clinic.
Just like that. Where a fox may have calculated the odds, considered the upside and the downside, the hedgehog simply picked up and went. In Mexicali, Don found a dusty border town in the desert where the people were very poor.
I mean, most of the houses were made of packing crates at that time, and there was no paving in Mexicali of 200,000 people.
Mexicali's main medical facility was an old wood home.
It had a dirt floor for part of it. The back part of the clinic was used to raise fighting cocks.
A rational fox may have calculated the risks and backed down. Not Don. He recruited local health officials to get word out that they would be providing free surgeries for children with cleft lips and burn scars. The clinic was quickly packed.
It was 10:30 in the morning. In that desert, there had not been rain there for 3 years. Hot in the morning, it was about 106 degrees already. You couldn't touch anything metal because you'd burn your hand. The first patient I saw was sitting there with a bag on his head with two little peepholes. I said, why the bag?
Behind those peepholes, the boy was hiding his face in shame. Don asked if he could take a look.
So he got the bag off, and he had a burn scar to pull this eyelid down. A simple thing to repair.
As with Sandy, Don wanted to make the little boy unremarkable. He wanted him to lead an ordinary life, unmarked by stigma and shame. That first trip was just a fact-finding mission, a way to see if there was a need. By the time Don went back to Stanford, a plan had formed in his mind. He wanted to recruit the best doctors from the United States and fly them to Mexico to perform free surgeries on children with birth defects. He recruited surgical residents to join skilled surgeons on the trips. He found pilots willing to transport medical equipment. Hedgehogs have charisma. They can see the shining city on the hill so clearly that everyone around them starts to see it too.
Everybody jumped on it. I had to hide when I go in the hospital because people wanted to get in on this.
In 1966, the official medical missions began. Now, it's important to remember that at this time, the idea of plastic surgeons going abroad to provide free surgery was almost unheard of. There were fewer parameters of how international aid organizations should operate. Don was flying by the seat of his pants. Every few months, the doctors would descend on Mexicali. They'd throw themselves into 4 marathon days of back-to-back surgeries and consultations. Over the years, they'd come back again and again, performing more than 2,000 surgeries in all. One of Don's first patients was a little boy named Eugenio. He was the boy who'd worn the bag over his head. Don repaired the scarred eyelid and still remembers the boy's first reaction.
He had a very nice, huge smile.
On a follow-up trip, Don tracked Eugenio down.
He shook hands and everything like that, even as a young kid. And he said, I have friends at school now.
Don loved it.
It's a real happiness. It's a source of happiness is the best description.
Don had I would describe it as a very, and I think he would accept this, I think it was a very sort of a missionary zeal.
This is plastic surgeon Howard Holderness. He was part of the team of residents helping perform surgeries in Mexicali. Howard says that Don's vision drove the whole team.
I think he felt very close to trying to do things that not only practice medicine in all of its forms of science and everything, but the art of medicine and some of the spiritual aspects of being a good doctor.
He was doing more than surgeries. Don was developing a program that could set an example for others to follow around the world. One day, about 2 years into the Mexico program, a woman arrived at the clinic with her young son. His name was Salvador. Compared with the other patients, Salvador had a more severe birth defect. He had bilateral clefts, 2 clefts rather than one.
When you have this bilateral, the muscles are cut twice. So when you smile, they pull out. If they're repaired, they pull in. See? So every time he would have a facial expression, it would be awful. You'd see these teeth on both sides.
Salvador was a perfect candidate for surgery. That is, until a doctor on the team gave the boy a thorough physical and listened to his heart with a stethoscope.
His mother brought him in, and the pediatrician listened, and it goes whoosh, 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 the heart sounds.
These were not normal sounds. The boy's heart had a hole in it. The risk of proceeding with surgery was small, but potentially fatal. They gave the mother the bad news.
We can't operate because we don't have the equipment in Mexicali to do the heart catheterization or anything like that, or even get the EKG today. So
Don and his team turned away the mother and the little boy. I should say here that we're going only on Don's account of what happened. The medical records from that era are incomplete, and we weren't able to find the mother. A few months after sending the child away, Don and his team were back in Mexicali. The mother and her son were waiting for them again. Salvador, she told them, was shunned. He had no friends. Other children called him El Monstre, the monster.
The mother said, "This child has no chance in life. You gotta fix it."
Don's heart went out to the little boy. He explained the danger again. The risk was small, but it did mean that things could go seriously wrong. Don held the stethoscope up to the mother's ears.
"Listen, she can hear it. Whoosh, whoosh, whoosh."
So the answer again was no. More months passed. Don returned to the clinic. So did the mother.
"Por favor. Please, doctor. Can you see the child has no life?"
This was a critical moment. Don could again have said no. Medical protocol said that was the right call. But Don also knew that without surgery, Salvador would always be an outcast. Could he have tried to take the boy back to Stanford, where heart surgeons could have assisted with his care? Maybe. But that would have been complicated, expensive, and a drain on critical resources from the project in Mexico, resources that were helping hundreds of other children. So Don did what Don always did. He took a look at the child, took a deep breath, and said, "Okay, we'll do it."
"I feel like that's why I existed, is for this judgment. I mean, I'm not there to take care of little pimples. I'm there to do the tough cases. So this was putting it right on the line. You got to do it or put your tail between your legs and get out of there."
It's been nearly 50 years since Don Law performed that surgery on a 6-year-old boy in Mexicali, Mexico. He's had thousands of patients since then, but the details of that day are still vivid in his mind. The morning of the surgery, the boy went through the standard pre-surgery lab tests and checkup. An IV was started, and he received extra glucose in case his blood sugar was low from stomach worms. And then the boy walked by himself into the operating room.
"And he gets on the operating table himself, because he trusts the whole world."
The surgery began. First, the child was anesthetized.
"So that went fine. It went perfect. No problem at all."
Then Don and his team began the surgery.
"When we were operating, everything was going perfect."
And then, just like that, it wasn't.
"Anesthesiologist said, boys, we have no pulse."
They tried everything. CPR, medicine to jumpstart the heart. Nothing worked. Don suspected a blood clot. The boy was dead. They put away their surgical tools. They wheeled the body to the morgue. All the while, Don's heart was starting to race. He was working in a foreign country, and he had made a risky judgment call in violation of medical protocol.
"My mind is going 1,000 miles a minute. Why am I here in Mexico? Why did I get into this? What the hell is the matter with you? Here you are in a foreign country. You're going to end up in jail. It's just a disaster. An awful thing."
And of course, there was the boy's mother waiting anxiously outside for news of her son. Don remembers stepping out of the operating room and walking up to her. He told her there'd been complications, that they had tried hard, but the boy had died. The mother began to sob. But then, Don says, she did something surprising. She asked him why he was upset.
"She said, you should be happy because the child is seeing God with a complete face."
Don had expected accusation and anger. Instead, he encountered a mother who leaned heavily on her faith. Don says she was comforted by the thought that her child was now repaired and beautiful and at home with God. Salvador was finally at peace. Don stared at the mother. He was speechless, not just because of what she'd said, but because he was struck by another thought. The mother didn't know this, but Salvador's face was not repaired. He died before the surgery was complete. What would the mother say when she saw her son at the funeral? Again, the medical protocol was clear. Don had to turn the body over to Salvador's mother. But he felt he couldn't bring himself to do this. It would only compound the first tragedy. He conferred with his team about finishing the surgery on Salvador.
I said it's against the law, but I think in this case, we should.
The rest of the team unanimously agreed. The little boy was brought back from the morgue.
The child came back on a body bag, and we did the whole thing as if the child was awake.
It took 25 minutes to complete the surgery. I interviewed Don several times for the story. I pushed hard to understand why he decided to operate on Salvador. What were you telling yourself, again, emotionally, that made you change your mind, that made you say, yes, I recognize there's a risk, but I have to do this?
I thought, this is what I am for. This is my purpose.
And I said it's worth
it. I was standing there and I couldn't say no again. I couldn't. When I said that, let's go ahead and do the case, I didn't have any second thoughts. Emotionally, I figured out that this is what I should do.
Don still thinks about Salvador, has thought about him thousands of times over the years. He's turned the case over in his head in every possible way. I asked him over and over whether he felt regret.
No. Well, of course I do. Of course I do. Yes, I do. I mean, I said just a minute ago, it was a mistake. But I'm not whipping myself.
Not whipping himself, Don says, because he was trying to do the right thing. That's the reason he decided to operate. That's the reason he completed the surgery after the child was dead. What was more important than being on the right side of the law?
Doing the right thing.
By the mother and by the child.
Yes. Yeah. No, you must always do the right thing. That is the highest priority over all different laws and commandments or any of that thing. You have to do the right thing.
The day after Salvador died, Don Lobb was back in the operating room. There were more children waiting for surgery. He remembers looking out the windows at the sky. It was, he says, a perfect azure blue. At 10:30, the time when Salvador was to be buried, everyone on the team fell silent and paused. There was no sound except for the whoosh of the anesthesia machine. When we think of foxes and hedgehogs, it's completely understandable that we want the best of both worlds. We love bold visionaries who take big risks, except when the risks don't work. At moments like that, we prefer the visionaries to be more cautious, filled with a little self-doubt. Now, people don't always fall neatly into one camp or the other. Some of us can be both fox and hedgehog. We can think and dream big, but also change course, adapt to circumstances. But it may be that we can't have our cake and eat it too. If we want the visionary Steve Jobs who helped usher in the age of the iPhone, we might also get the tyrannical CEO who nearly ran Apple computers into the ground in the 1980s. It's odd to think of Gandhi and Napoleon and Churchill and Mao in the same breath, but they are cut from the same cloth of messianic vision. It's easy not to like the kind of people who create history's greatest failures. But it turns out, they're also the people who produce our greatest triumphs. This week's show was produced by Kara McGurk-Allison, Maggie Penman, Jenny Schmidt, and Thomas Liu. It was edited by Tara Boyle. Our team includes Parth Shah, Raina Cohen, and Laura Quirrell. Some of the music in today's show was composed by Ramtin Arablouei. For more Hidden Brain, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can also listen to my stories on your local public radio station. I'm Shankar Vedantam. See you next week.
Support for Hidden Brain comes from the George and Faye Young Foundation. This is NPR. Support for NPR comes from this station and from CBS All Access with the new season of its original series, The Good Fight. Christine Baranski returns to lead the fight, now streaming on CBS All Access. More at cbs.com/thegoodfight. From the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the estate of Joan Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.